And that music is perfect for the segment we're beginning now. Thank you guys in the control room. Eric and, of course, Will Craven, our great producer. He brings us all kinds of interesting news from around the world, from all aspects of green. And we're going to talk about sort of the big picture in this segment. And it's not gloom and doom. It's about slowing down, breathing, getting in touch with Mother Nature. And yes, we are part of it. And in the midst of all these legislative maneuvers, it's important to remember that these are not ends in themselves, but rather a means to preserve our planet and the feeling of really being connected to the Earth and its inspiring, amazing, instructive, and beautifully complicated cycles. Not to sound too California here, but we are nature, of course, and nature is us. And if we take responsibility for Mother Earth, she, of course, we hope will take care of us. That's what's gotten us thus far along the journey, and a good chunk of humankind's journey on Earth is captured in Liza Dalby's new memoir, East Wind Melts the Ice, a memoir through the seasons. Part memoir, part gardener's diary, and excursion through cultures east and west. It's the perfect antidote to the 24-hour news cycles. These are wiser cycles to sustain us. Welcome to the Green Street Studios.
Thank you. That's really a very good way of putting it, I think.
So tell us about what inspired you to write this memoir. Was it meant to be sort of a rumination on nature? And when you got the seeds, pardon the expression, because you talk a lot about gardening here, I think, did you anticipate, you know, global warming and some of these major eco challenges being at the top of the news? I mean, who could have foreseen it coming up so suddenly?
Yes, it makes you very aware of that thing. But that was not my original impetus. I discovered this very ancient Chinese almanac when I was doing research for my previous novel about an 11th century Japanese court woman. And I was interested in what she might have known about Chinese culture. So I discovered this almanac that basically divides the year into 72 separately named units. So I think, if you know, we think of the year as going through four seasons that continually cycle, but imagine that you take 72 steps rather than just four. And I think because I am a gardener, this really appealed to me to look at each unit and what was happening in the natural world. So, for example, East Wind Melts the Ice is the name of the first unit at the very beginning of spring.
Is that referring to the ice changing up in the North Pole and Antarctica?
Well, no, but these are 72 rather poetic phrases. They're all drawn from some aspect of the natural world, things that are changing. So you could see the progression of the seasonal changes through the year by watching it. And I became curious about this almanac itself and tried to trace it, to understand it within its original Chinese context. And in order to do that, you have to understand how the Chinese saw the world in terms of the yin ethers and the yang ethers. It was a sort of cosmological view of the world. And if everything went properly, then people would prosper and the world would be fine. Now, there is a very interesting human element in this, which was in the person of the emperor, because originally the Chinese emperor was the one who coordinated all these natural phenomenon. He had to have proper ritual activities. And it's very interesting because if the natural world, if the glaciers started warming, started melting or the equivalent, this would mean that the emperor was not doing his job. And I think when I finished the book, what I realized is we're not talking about the emperor anymore, but the human element is very much all of us. And all of these natural phenomena that are now going out of whack, the glaciers, the tree frogs.
The droughts, the
drought. These
fires.
Are all telling us that we are in danger of losing the mandate of heaven because things are really very much getting out of whack.
We've had a lot of green folk in the studio. This may be the first time we've had a geisha in the studio. You call yourself an American geisha.
Let's say ex-geisha, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that and the connection to green.
Well, the Japanese geisha were the subject of my PhD dissertation in anthropology. And in the course of doing my field work as I was studying these women, they invited me to join them and actually become a geisha for a year. So that's, you know...
How unusual is that for an American
woman? Well, it's pretty unusual. It's part of my background. I've tried to go on and do other things. But The interesting thing that I found in writing the series of essays based on this almanac, which, by the way, I originally tried writing these in Japanese because I wanted to see if I could, you know, have a writing voice, if I could write prose in Japanese, which I had never tried doing before. And as I did that, I adopted a Japanese writing style, which is, it's much looser than an English essay. Sort of things get connected one thing to another. And I found that the essays would draw on aspects of my memories. I really didn't intend to write a memoir, but that's kind of how it ended up.
Where does the Asian influence in your life come from? Because you look Caucasian.
Oh, yeah.
And yet you not only speak Japanese, obviously, if you write it, you must be fluent. Maybe you think in Japanese. Where did that come in?
Well, I first went to Japan as a high school student and have continued to go back throughout my life. And I think that the if I had to say what was the most influential aspect of Japanese culture on me, it would be the close attention that they pay to the seasons.
And what is the consciousness there right now around issues like climate change and what's happening to our oceans and just all the levels on which we're taxing Mother Earth? Are they as... I mean, their cars are certainly very progressive, you know, the hybrid cars, Toyota,
in general,
Honda.
The Japanese have a great tendency to think green. You know, aside from this weird issue of the whales, which is, in fact, one of the subjects of one of my essays, I think Japanese are very attuned to these issues.
Okay, so they're concerned, and do you see changes taking place there in terms of solar panels when you go over there?
Oh, very much so.
They're really embracing renewable energy development.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
I thought so. Just wondered what your view of that was. So as the U.S. substituted fiscal madness, do you think, and baseball seasons and all the election cycles, fourth quarter profits, the next, you know, quarter's profits, in place of real seasons, have we really lost touch with, you know, what used to guide people in their, you know, rhythms?
Oh, I think we are profoundly disconnected from seasons. I mean, even the Western calendar, I would argue, is a very artificial construct. Now, as an anthropologist, one of the things that interests me about calendars and almanacs is you have it's a cultural system. These are ways of ordering time and sort of placing yourself in time in the universe. But they also, of course, draw on the natural world. So it's that intersection between nature and culture that I think gets expressed in calendars. And different cultures have very different ways of viewing them. So what I discovered in this Chinese almanac was a way of really being aware of the seasons in a way that makes sense. And, for example, one of my pet peeves is the fact that we've just passed what we call the beginning of spring. In fact, it's the spring equinox, and it just, to me, it's been spring since early February. You see the beginning signs of it, and right now, it's not the beginning of spring. Like, spring is in full force out there.
Yeah, the hills are green, the flowers are blooming, it's beautiful. And yet, at least here, it was a little bit hotter, a little bit earlier, which, of course, makes some of us a little nervous.
Well, there's always a certain kind of variation, but I think also one of the values of having a structure like an almanac is it makes you much more aware when things are occurring differently from the usual order.
Just in today's Wall Street Journal Marketplace, there's a front page story about global warming, uncool on the slopes, how the ski resorts are getting very concerned.
Yes, uh-huh.
We just had someone on who was talking about the syrup industry in Vermont.
Yes,
it used to be 80% produced in Vermont, 20% in Canada. Now it's completely reversed. And there are so many signs that our seasons are changing. How can a book like yours make folks, you know, even more aware of what we must preserve or what we'll lose, maybe that's another way to put it, if we really continue down this path of fueling with Mother Nature and all that implies and includes?
I think, you know, if my book has a message, it's really open your eyes. You know, just see what's around you and pay attention, because that has to be the basis, you know, for any kind of change, I think.
It's interesting that this is obviously hitting, just as another example that's in the news a lot, the ski resorts are certainly dependent on snow and seasons. It's hitting their bottom line first. And all of a sudden, they're getting, you know, a green makeover, green consciousness all over. Is that, I guess, what it's going to take in a lot of areas in terms of industries being hit for the kind of resources and money and attention to be paid to what they're doing? I mean, they're reducing their CO2 output at ski resorts, but obviously that's not going to make enough of a difference across the board. But I guess we just have to
make
that happen
will
over
be,
and over.
Yes, more and more of these things that get people's attention, and it's going to be impossible to ignore.
I guess it's just too bad that it takes these crises to wake people up, but that's human nature, isn't it?
That's what it takes.
Mm. Yeah. So are you overall optimistic about us, we humans, getting back sort of in a relationship with nature that's a little bit more mutually healthy?
Well, I think nature is going to sort of go on its way, and it's really up to humans to adapt or not. I mean, the future of the Earth will be what it will be, and we kind of have a choice whether we will, get with that or not.
We have just about a minute left. I wondered if you might be able to read a small excerpt as we go to commercial.
Okay, I'll try.
From your book.
This was in an essay that started out talking about mulberries and ended up talking about geisha. Geisha today may be the only women left in Japan who still paint their faces white. When my geisha sister did my makeup for the first time, she warned me to cover my mouth when I smiled. I thought she was giving me a lesson in female etiquette. I forgot her advice, and when I saw a photograph of myself, teeth bared in a smile, I was horrified. Suddenly, I understood. With skin painted matte white, one's teeth cannot but look dingy yellow in contrast. Geisha have learned to smile with their mouths closed, accounting partly, I think, for their enigmatic aura. In reality, they are simply hiding their teeth.
Beautiful. Liza Dalby, thank you so much. The book is East Wind Melts the Ice, a memoir through the seasons. And we'll be back right after we go through these messages.